Although the first computers were the size of a large room, they possessed the processing power of a calculator and the cell phones we use today. In his latest book, Technology, historian George Dyson is less concerned with those limitations than with the intricate web of academics, institutions, government organizations, and even social factors that make up the computer's creation myth. Turing's Cathedral, Origins of the Digital Universe, is published by Pantheon, and I'm very pleased that it brings George Dyson to our show today. Hello.
Thank you.
Now, you've called your book Turing's Cathedral, but Alan Turing doesn't make a substantial appearance until the final part of the story. Why name the book after him, then?
Well, he was the person who contributed the main conceptual idea behind the whole thing. So if you view this whole world of computation as a cathedral, you know, built by innumerable people who put sort of one brick here and another brick there, he's at the foundation of it all.
Now, he'd worked on breaking German secret codes during World War II. Did that lead to some of the thinking that went into his creation of the Turing machine?
It was the other way around. He, you be careful using the word invent, but he invented what we now call the Turing machine in the 1930s before the World War II.
So he was already thinking in terms of algorithms and the sorts of things that we associate with computers today.
Very much so. And then suddenly there was this need to understand codes in a very direct way that was sort of a life or death question.
He did the first designs for a stored program computer.
That's arguable. I mean, I subscribe to the view that he did, that what he showed in his 1936 paper really was a stored program, that you could read the code that essentially encoded the behavior of another machine within a second machine.
Did he actually create a machine?
No, not until later. The group that he was part of at Bletchley Park in England, then they started building real physical machines to break these codes, and those were Turing machines.
We could only wonder what he might have been able to do if he had lived longer. He committed suicide a little before his 42nd birthday.
Yes. We don't know for sure he committed suicide.
He died of
cyanide poisoning. But his mother, for instance, always believed he had not committed suicide.
So. And it's kind of shocking that this man who had done so much and helped in the British war effort would feel like he was driven to suicide because he had been sentenced to go to prison because he was homosexual.
Yes, and he was offered the alternative of prison or estrogen injections, and he chose the injections.
Which is kind of like what they call it, chemical castration.
Yes, yeah.
Now,
brutal.
Why would they want to chemically castrate him?
That was the laws in England at the time. He's now been. You know, there's been a formal apology from the British government, but it's a little late.
Well, the central character in your book is the mathematician John von Neumann. Why didn't you name the book after him?
Because then everyone would say, well, he just took Turing's ideas, so give Turing the title credit. I mean, Turing deserves it, and there were many other people involved in the growth of computing besides von Neumann. So von Neumann happens to be a central character because so much of his papers were left sort of unlooked at, and I happened to look through them. But there's other characters.
Well, you write that he began studying with university professors at 13. He's another one of these incredible minds. He had his first paper published at 17, began teaching at Princeton at 26. He has a pretty incredible creation myth of his own.
Yes, and 25 years after coming to America as a Hungarian immigrant, he had essentially a cabinet level appointment under President Eisenhower. So.
Laszlo Ratzet, a legendary math teacher and economist, told John's father it would be nonsensical to teach him math in a conventional way. So, how did he learn math?
He primarily taught himself by doing it, and then his first degree was actually in chemical engineering. His father didn't believe that math was sort of a secure future.
So he was in chemical engineering, then he also dabbled in physics, applied math. Was that typical today? All of these different areas seem to be so much more specialized.
Yes, no, it was a different world then. I mean, he also helped create game theory and worked on explosives and shockwaves and just about everything.
And nobody thought that this was unusual, that that somebody could be doing all these different things?
No. You know, a large part of this, I think, was the war effort, where we needed to get all this stuff done, and people put aside their sort of differences and work together in a way we don't today.
So how did he come to working on the what now becomes a computer?
Okay, well, so make a very long story short, he comes to America in 1930. Alan Turing comes to Princeton in 1936. They see a lot of each other over 2 years. Turing goes back to break codes, and von Neumann is given the problems of how to develop nuclear weapons, which likewise required computation. And I think he very immediately, you know, remembered what he had learned from Turing. And then he ran into the people in Philadelphia who were building our secret computer, the ENIAC, and sort of saw how to turn that into a more powerful machine. Whether that was his idea or not, we don't really know.
Neil deGrasse Tyson was on our show last week, and he argues that we might not have had a serious U.S. space program if there hadn't been a Cold War. Could we say the same about the first programs to build computers?
Yes. Yeah, it was definitely the question of who would get the hydrogen bomb first that drove this. And it was von Neumann who went into Congress with two graphs showing that the rockets were getting bigger and the bombs were getting smaller, and at a certain point you would have a rocket big enough to launch a bomb, and that point might occur in the Soviet Union first.
He believed that the computer would, in some ways, was more dangerous than nuclear weapons. Why?
He was more afraid of it. He could see where it would go, and he was very both optimistic and afraid of controlling the weather, that he believed once we had powerful enough computers to predict the weather, we would then be able to control it, and then it was a question of who controlled the weather.
Well, so on the one hand, he has these moral compunctions. On the other hand, he's working for the Army and the Atomic Energy Commission because they're financing his experiments.
Yes. No, he was very – you have to remember, you know, he came from a time when most of these refugee scientists had lost large parts of their family to the Holocaust, and they were very determined that we would – you know, that these weapons be developed on our side.
But he doesn't strike me as an Edward Teller type.
Well, in some ways, he was more Edward Teller than Edward Tellerish and Edward Teller. You know, von Neumann was more emphatic about preemptive attack on the Soviet Union than Edward Teller was. But they were close friends. They came, you know, they went to the same high school, and neither of them, that's sort of a caricature. They both had more complex ideas at heart.
Another character in this book is Robert Oppenheimer.
Yes.
Who was less friendly to Teller. What about to von Neumann?
Oppenheimer and von Neumann had a very sort of distant relationship. You have to remember that they were together in Göttingen before the war. So there was sort of a rivalry there, and I think that never went away. And that, von Neumann had a code name for Oppenheimer that was Melisende, and I'm not exactly sure what the meaning of that is, but I got to see a lot of very confidential papers, and in there, for instance, a very strong recommendation by von Neumann that Oppenheimer should not become the director of this institute. And so,
despite his brilliance,
yes, that he was brilliant and he had done a great job at Los Alamos, but he should not administrate this.
Now, you talk about confidential papers. Where did you find the confidential papers?
Well, a lot of them in von Neumann's daughter's basement. And
so they had not been read before?
Not by, you know, not by historians. And a lot, the Institute themselves were very kind to open up a lot of their old files. And so I've tried to be very, sort of live up to that trust by just using what would eliminate the history of computing but not reflect badly on anybody. But there was a lot of rivalry in those times.
George Dyson is my guest. He has written a book called Turing's Cathedral, The Origins of the Digital Universe. Von Neumann told his wife that he was, quote, creating a monster whose influence is going to change history provided there's history left. So what was his conception of the computers that they were creating?
Well,
did he see them simply as weapons-building machines?
No, he saw they would go both ways. But that quote is applying partly to the nuclear weapons themselves. That was, quote, was shortly after the first test at Trinity. And but, you know, he was thinking ahead to what computers would do, that we would, you know, that our side or the others, at that time we really were in the Cold War. He saw that coming. He was far more afraid of the Russians than he was of the Nazis.
Although the Nazis, of course, had been responsible for killing his family, for him coming to this country.
Yes, but
were people unaware that the Soviets were not all that advanced in developing computers?
Well, the problem was we didn't know that, and you have to remember that von Neumann, for instance, worked at Los Alamos closely with Klaus Fuchs, and they were working on what they thought was a workable hydrogen bomb design, and then it turned out that Klaus Fuchs was a spy.
And sent all of the information to the Soviet Union.
As far as von Neumann knew, or he was afraid that they might, you know, they might. And then we later found out, of course, that the Germans had not got very far, and then the Russians were behind us as well.
Von Neumann was partly responsible for building ENIAC, the first operational modern computer. Didn't he have a hard time convincing corporations like RCA and IBM to take part?
Well, the first part of that is wrong. The ENIAC was fully built and almost functional when von Neumann showed up, so he played no role in the ENIAC was developed independently. He helped apply it. He helped write the codes that started doing things with it.
And they used to etch those codes on wire.
Yeah, on the later machine that von Neumann built, the input-output was on magnetic recording wire, which was the medium of the time. They didn't have tape yet.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the kind of thing von Neumann was so good at. He was he really was a big businessman, not a small businessman. And he very successfully convinced RCA and IBM in fact, he was consulting for IBM already in May 1945. So that's really what gave IBM such a big head start.
The engineers who constructed these early computers used analog parts like vacuum tubes, wire, even two old bike wheels. That doesn't make it seem like it was all that intricate or as well-funded as we might have expected.
Yeah, they did. Well, this entire von Neumann computer, what we call the Institute for Advanced Study Computer, was
that at Princeton?
Yes, it was not at Princeton University, but at an independent institute. Nonprofit there, and they did the whole thing for under $1 million in sort of 5 years. So it wasn't a huge project. It was just very creative.
Well, it was huge in another way. ENIAC required over 17,000 vacuum tubes, a 500,000 hand-soldered joints, and occupied a room that was 33 by 35.
Okay, well, that was the earlier, the ENIAC was the earlier machine built in Philadelphia at the University of Pennsylvania, and then the Institute machine was much, much smaller. I mean, it was a 50th the size.
But had more capability of storing things?
It was just vastly faster. I mean, it was the difference between your old calculator and your iPad or something.
Now, they were storing things on punch cards at that point. In fact, punch cards lasted until fairly recently.
Punch cards are still in use.
Really? Would they be in use today when we have these computers that, when I have a smartphone that seems to be able to do practically anything a computer can do?
I did a story on this a few years ago, and it was amazing how many punch cards were still. For instance, the Central New York Housing and Mortgage Authority still had all their data on punch cards, and 20th Century Fox was still doing their payroll on punch cards.
You describe another computer was assembled by Julian Bigelow as resembling a turbocharged V-40 engine.
Yes, that's the machine that most of this story is about, and it was brilliantly designed.
Was that called the ENIAC?
Yes, it's a mathematical and numerical integrator and computer, and it was just a beautiful piece of physical engineering, just brilliantly done.
You've written this book more like a crime caper than an academic biography. Was it important for you to reflect on the complex web of the computer's creators through the writing of the book?
Yes. I mean, I went into it sort of very open-minded. I'm going to see everything I can find and then somehow find a storyline that sort of weaves its way through it, based primarily on the people. And I think one of the strongest characters is Clary von Neumann, because she was a very interesting person, and she also kept journals in very good English of what what she was seeing every day.
To most people today, the whole process began in Silicon Valley about 20 years ago. Why did it take so long for computers to be made that much smaller and then use keyboards and a mouse?
Well, I would think on the contrary that it actually, it's amazing how quick the evolution went. I mean, from sort of, you know, these first room-sized devices in 1945, and, you know, by 1960 we have a big mainframe data processing industry, and then suddenly the microchip is invented, and from there it was just unstoppable.
So it was the invention of the microchip, not the transistor.
The transistor had a big effect, but transistorized computers were still large things that, you know, you had to move around with a forklift, and it was the microchip that you know, put them in our pockets.
And now we are trying to go past the microchip.
It's anybody's guess where this really goes, but the chips just keep getting smaller and faster.
You had a chance to read the error logs from the first uses. What was going wrong?
The same problems we have today. You know, your program will crash, and was it hardware or software? And it switched from at the beginning, the codes were small and the problems were mainly hardware, and then very quick, didn't take many years till the codes became complicated enough that the problems were mostly software, which is the world we live in today.
George Dyson will be in conversation with his father, Freeman Dyson, and with Claudia Dreyfus. That's tonight at 8:15 at the 92nd Street Y. For more information, you can visit our show page at WNYC.org. The book, Turing's Cathedral, The Origins of the Digital Universe, published by Pantheon. And my great thanks to George Dyson for being on our show today.
Thank you very much.